goodie bags either.
Yeah.
You forgive me if I sound a little bit dogmatic tonight. I'm actually not very dogmatic about surveys. In many ways, you can do surveys, but I must admit I have some biases. It's the way I think surveys should be done. I should probably begin. Some of you have taken David's, or are taking David's course on archaeology of this area. And he began a little bit of the history of archaeology. He mentioned some people who did early topographical studies of the Holy Land in particular. People like Edward Robinson came to this part of the world, and they were really the first people to do survey here. They were interested in identifying the sites associated with ancient place names, and they did very valuable research. The one thing which they unfortunately lacked was techniques to date the sites, unless they happened to have inscriptions from the sites. It was very difficult for them to date the sites, and it wasn't until, sometime on in the 20th century, particularly after Albrecht's excavations in Tal Beit Mirsum, that we then had the tool of pottery chronology. This allowed people to date the sites, and you could find out that some of the identifications of sites with ancient place names were wrong, because you could show by the sherds that these sites weren't occupied at the periods that they would have had to have been occupied when the this ancient site was supposed to have been occupied. Now that we had this tool, we sort of revitalized archaeological survey in this area, and probably the biggest name of archaeological survey in Jordan has always been Nelson Gluck. He, particularly in the 30s, went and did quite a massive survey of this whole area and discovered hundreds of sites. And because he had the pottery chronology to back him up, he could create sort of ceramic histories of various areas. He could date sites to various periods. And he did very pioneering work. The trouble was that his survey, although very valuable, it was somewhat haphazard. If he went to an area of, say, 400 square kilometers, he might find 20 sites, and he could tell you that he found sites in periods A, B, and C, but although he might tell you that he didn't find any Middle Bronze Age sites, for example, in this area, that doesn't necessarily mean that there are no Middle Bronze Age sites, because it is conceivable that he just didn't look in another place, because there's no way the type of survey he did would give you information on all the sites in the region. In fact, the other problem was that you get a bias in favor of certain kinds of sites. And surveys like the kind that Nelson Gluck did tended to be biased in favor of the upper end of what's called termed the site spectrum. Just to give you an idea of what I mean by this, if we were to do a very complete survey of an area and plot the number of sites we find in a given period against the sizes of these sites, we find a whole bunch of new tiny sites, which maybe are farmhouses and this kind of thing. We find somewhat smaller number of a little bit larger sites, which might be hamlets or small villages, and then some bigger villages, and then we find very few sites which are big towns or large tells, this type of thing. Nelson Gluck's surveys tend to concentrate on this kind of site. One with visible architecture, large tells, fortification walls, this type of thing. So while these surveys are very useful for reconstructing certain kinds of history, they don't give you the total picture. And this is the thing which surveys during the past 30 or 40 years have gradually been working towards giving you a more complete picture than you can get from surveys like Nelson Gluck's. The other developments in survey in this area were largely influenced by some surveys in Iraq, particularly down up in the Diyala Valley here and down around Warsaw. In this area, done by a man named Adams from the late 50s through the 60s and 70s. His surveys actually developed through this period. They started out being very similar to the kinds of surveys Nelson Gluck was doing, and they gradually developed. But during the course of doing these surveys, Adams found that he became interested in particular types of archaeological problems, which survey might give the answers to, but only if you approach the survey in a particular way. So he began to be interested in looking for changes in the size of the population in ancient times, and for differences in land use patterns, differences in the extent of irrigation being used in Mesopotamia in different periods. And this began to redirect people's thinking about how to do surveys. At the same time, there were surveys being done in other parts of the world by archaeologists, and they were also addressing different kinds of problems and coming up with different issues which required different kinds of survey methodology. So there has been quite a continuous development. The problem now is that there are a lot of archaeologists who would like to use techniques like statistics on their survey data. And if you were to take Nelson Hook's data, for instance, although it is very good for certain types of problems, it's basically illegitimate to use that data for any kind of statistical analysis, because you'd have to have a certain set of assumptions when you use statistics, which just were not in the original data set of Nelson Hook. The other problem is there are some kinds of analysis which archaeologists would like to do, particularly ones they borrow from geographers, which require that you know where all the sites are. And there's certainly none of us who knows where all the sites are. For instance, if you wanted to try and reconstruct the borders between different city-states, geographers have worked out ways to hypothesize where these borders should be. But if you were to draw a map showing where these sites are, if you're missing three sites, you're going to get the wrong answers when you try and reconstruct these borders. So there are all these new problems, and we have to try and address them when we design a survey project. Now, I was saying that Nelson Gluck's survey was good for constructing ceramic histories. Most of the surveys which had been done in the past after Nelson Gluck were of this sort. They're what I term inventory surveys. They are valuable in that they give us a good idea of what kinds of archaeological resources are available in the region, and they have tended to be particularly attractive to people looking for sites to excavate or to the antiquities department who wants information on how to manage and preserve important sites, particularly ones with architecturally large sites, which can give them big stratigraphic sequences and this type of thing. But once we start to look for information on some of these other problems, it becomes a little more complicated. There are a number of things which we have to address. The first one, and this may sound a little bit silly, is that we have to define what we mean by a site. Look in an introductory textbook on archaeology, they probably give you a definition of a site, something like a locus of human activity. And in a sense, this is the kind of site which archaeologists are interested in. But when you're doing a survey, you need an operational definition of the site, because that definition is basically very difficult to work with in the field. First of all, if you were to walk along and find a single shirt on the ground, you'd have to admit that was an example of human activity. Made this shirt or this lithic artifact, because that's the case. But if you went and actually plotted every single shirt you found in the survey, you spent 100 years and you'd never get it in this part of the world, please. And it's fair to say that most archaeologists doing surveys don't have that detailed definition of site. On the other hand, you could go and just define your site in such a way to reflect your interest in intel. So if you're looking for particular kinds of intel, you can find your site in such a way as to give you that information. You run into another problem when you define a site. If you were to define site as any scatter of sherds or artifacts on the ground, is this really a locus of human activity? Is these sherds and lithics being washed downhill from someplace else? Unless you're a geomorphologist, you may have a very difficult time determining whether this is really a locus of human activity. So your definition of site is probably going to have to be some kind of compromise. The important thing, I feel, is that it should be designed to address the problems we're interested in. Every archaeologist in the field is interested in different kinds of things. The second thing which an archaeologist has to think about in this sort of survey is what he means by survey universe is what term for it. It's basically the boundaries of your survey area. This is a term which has recently been picked up by archaeologists and statisticians, in a sense. They're trying to find a term. The statistician would be interested in the term population, which would be all the sites in the region. And because we don't know where the sites are ahead of time, we can't really define the population very well. So what we do is we pick boundaries for the survey area. All this sort of survey universe. This is a minor thing, but it's important that the archaeologist or anyone who's going to sample an area, and we must remember that surveying surface collection is just as much as archaeological excavation constitutes destruction, needs to be able to inform other people through publication or through talks or whatever, exactly what he did, and he needs to tell exactly what the boundaries of his area. Ideally, if you were to sample an area like this, the boundaries of the area should correspond to the boundaries of the ancient cultural group that you're interested in. If one was doing a survey of Moab, for instance, and wanted to draw conclusions about, say, settlement patterns of Moab, if you went and only surveyed a very tiny area of Moab, and then tried to extrapolate that information to generalize for all of Moab, that really won't be correct. It might not be far off, but technically speaking, that shouldn't be correct. At the same time, if you were trying to generalize about Moab, and you included in your survey area places which are really part of Edom or Ammon, that wouldn't be correct either, because you'd be contaminating your data with information about sites which don't really belong. So this is actually much more important than it seems. Sounds kind of silly, but we really need to be explicit about some of these things. The most important thing is sampling. A lot of people don't realize that every time anyone digs a hole into a site, or anytime somebody picks up sherds or lithics off the surface of a site, whether he knows it or not, he's sampling. There's some people who say they don't use sampling, but everybody uses sampling. The important thing is you should tell people how you sample the site. Once you remove those sherds from the ground, nobody's going to be able to put them back exactly where they were, and information will be lost unless we can tell other people where the sherds came from and how they were chosen. Because all of us have biases. Some of us may look at a green shirt, some of us have a red shirt, painted ones as opposed to plain ones. And the thing is, when you try to get archaeological information from the sherds, you want to know how you chose these different shirts. Are they representative of the rest of the shirts on the site? So these are something we have to address. One thing that's important about sampling is that whether we know it or not, even when we think we're finding all the sites in an area, given a particular definition of site, the chances are we're not really finding all the sites in the area. And if we want to do something like say there are no Middle Bronze Age sites in this area, we have to sample in such a way that we can say there's very high probability that there are Bronze Age sites in this area. If there's any chance that we've just missed the Middle Bronze Age sites because we were just haphazardly building the sites, then we can't really make statements about absences of sites. So this is why sampling becomes so important. Most of the sampling which was done certainly before Nelson Bluff and also by Nelson Bluff tended to be very intuitive or haphazard. But there was some degree always of very carefully thought out sampling of a particular kind, which we call purpose sampling. And people like Robinson, for instance, would purposively go to particular sites which they had linguistically identified with sites mentioned in the Bible or in the classical texts. And they went and checked these sites and tried to decide whether they thought these could be the ancient sites talked about in the literature. And that is one type of sampling, purposive collection. Basically, purposive sample, spell this. You're doing purposive sampling anytime you intentionally bias your sample in order to maximize the amount of information you're getting on a particular topic of interest to you. So if you're interested in early Bronze III sites, and you know that early Bronze III sites tend to be located in particular areas, and you go and intentionally look at all those areas and see if you can find even three sites, that's a purpose of sample. And it makes perfectly good sense to do that. Purpose of samples actually are much better than the other kind of sample when you know ahead of time what it is you're looking for, and you have a very good idea of what the characteristics of these sites are. That is the most efficient way to get the information you want. But the trouble is, most of the time, we don't have that kind of information. Another thing is that purposive samples don't allow you to predict unknown things. So based on things we already know. So when you want to predict or extrapolate or generalize to areas that you don't know about, you have to use another kind of sample, which is called a probability sample. These are the only kinds of samples. It's fading away. Only kinds of samples. Probability, yes. Maybe it is, yeah. These are the only kinds of samples on which you can use as a basis for generalization about larger groups that you haven't looked at. If you've looked at five sites, if you use a purposive sample, you can only talk about those five sites. Whereas if you use some kind of probability sample, you can say things about the probable characteristics of sites that you haven't used. You sort of extrapolate that way. Now, probability samples are of various kinds. The one that most of you have probably heard of is a random sample. And in a random sample, basically, if I were doing a survey of an area, this would mean when I look for sites in this area, every spot in this area has an equal chance of being examined to look for sites. Not only that, it means that every combination of spots in that area have an equal chance. And when you know absolutely nothing about an area, that's the most reasonable type of sample to use in many cases. Another kind of sample is a systematic sample. Now, where can spot? If we assume this square is our survey area, random sample could be points just randomly located, or it could be a series of lines that we walk along, which again just randomly located like that. Whereas a systematic sample is either going to be a series of equally spaced dots or squares or whatever, all in very you put across like this. Or you can have a transect, you walk straight on to the back. So in this case, this is exactly true, but if the sites were all the same size, in this case, every site would have an equal chance of being found. Because in this case, there's a site, only the first line is the site randomly. After that, all the others are determined by the spaces. If you find a site here, or if there is a site here or here, it has zero chance of being found if you do this only. You know, the purpose of sampling or something as well. But any sites along those lines will be found. Then there are other kinds of samples, most of which are combinations of these things. One which is an important kind that I should mention to you is called a stratified sample. Remember, this kind of sample, a random sample, is what you do when you know nothing about an area. And you can use this when you know about an area, too. But if you know something about the area, for instance, let's say you're looking for two kinds of sites. One site you know has a strong, from previous experience, you suspect has a strong tendency to be located up in mountainous areas. So you divide off the area of the map and you have mountainous areas. And another type of site tends to be located in lowlands. So you have an outline of lowlands and uplands. What you do is you sample those two parts separately. So you put either a random stratified sample, in which case you can put, let's say, random squares here, and you also randomly sample this part. That's just to make sure that both of those areas get a good chance of being examined for the kinds of information you want. Because if you just did a random sample, it could turn out that all your samples were over here, you wouldn't get any information in this part. So what you're doing is maximizing your use, maximizing the knowledge you already have by stratifying the area into zones which you think are useful for the research. And then you can combine these in many ways. You have stratified systematic, stratified random, and all kinds of other weird combinations. Now, when I say that we can predict things on the basis of these probability samples, what I mean, I should give you an example to tell you what I mean. Let us assume that we sampled this area and we found 40% of the sites. And we find that within our sample, 70% of the sites are always found in a particular environmental situation, say next to a spring, or on top of a hill, or on a particular kind of soil. If we had done a purposive sample, we couldn't say that the other 60% of the sites which we didn't survey were the same. But because we did a probability sample, we can say that within a certain range of probability, out of all the sites in the area, 70% of them are located next to springs, on top of hills, on hilltops, or whatever. And when I say within a certain range of probability, it could be, say, 65% to 75%, or 62% to 79%, something like that. You get a particular range. So instead of just saying, well, I think that these sites tend to be located on hilltops near springs, you can say we can be confident to, within this range, that 70% of these sites fall in these particular types of locations. And that is a step ahead of what you can do with a purpose example. And that is just one example. There are all kinds of other types of predictions that you can make, which are the same sort of category. If anybody has any questions, because I may not be all clear. Yeah,
you talked about the probability. How are you going to have any basis to work with to actually find things that these 10 in a row have to be on top of the mountain near water? Because you mentioned something like 60% of all of them are in a certain area.
Actually, I explained this very badly. Let's go back to this plot of the site size versus number of sites. Now, if we'd done a purposive sample, and we went and looked at all the sites that we could see for the reason, we'd probably find most of our sites in this range. Now, we would be tempted to say that all the sites in this region are this type. But in fact, there are these other sites which we just didn't know about, so we missed them. And we may have found some of them, but not very many. The point is that if this is, let's assume we made this is a plot of all the sites in the area, and we sampled probably half of the sites. What happens is we would get another graph. It looks the same, but it's smaller, because it's only going to be half as big. But it's not going to be exactly half. It's going to be close within the range of, say, 1 or 2% over there. And this we can do in the probability sample. We can say that because we found half the sites, and we get this kind of distribution of the sites, we multiply it times 2, and then add in that little bit of uncertainty, plus or minus 5%, or whatever it is, and this probably describes what is actually there in this valley, the survey area, the square, whatever it is. Does that make sense?
Exactly what I was saying.
So yeah, Gary.
Well, Kevin, I think one thing here, say that all the sites.
No. I'm oversimplifying. I'm saying if the sites are all the same size, let's say, because the problem is the sites are units and then areas are a different kind of unit. But let's assume for a minute all the sites are the same size. When we survey half of the area, then we know within a certain, again, within a certain probability, we have found half of the sites. You know, assuming that, well, let's say if it were a random distribution and we surveyed half the area, we would know we found half the sites within.
Basic premise that the whole area got the same distribution of sites.
No. What we're doing is we're saying there's a probability.
Okay.
Again, so you've got that range on it.
I still don't understand the difference between random and probability.
No, there is no difference. Probability includes, and we do it's random and systematic, and combinations of it, and stratified, different combinations of stratified. The difference between a probability sample and a purposive sample is that in a probability sample, at least one starting point in your survey area is chosen randomly. Like it has an equal chance with all the other places that being looked at. So if I go to a survey area and I decide myself where to look for sites, that's a purpose of sampling, because I'm the one who decides. And I presumably have various biases. I like to look on tops of hills, and I like to look in valleys or something. Whereas if I use a random sample or a stratified sample, I might get some dice from a Monopoly game and throw that on the table. If it says six, and I don't, you know, map, I go over six squares or something, that's where I start. The point is, something over which I have no control decides where I look. And that something gives every site in the region, theoretically, if they're all the same size, an equal chance of being found. Whereas if I decide, not all sites have an equal chance, because I'm biased. I might like sites which are tells is hot, or I might not like climbing up hills, or something like that.
Don't you have to sit in
No, I'm not deciding where to dig yet. You're getting ahead of yourself. No, I'll get to that. You're right. But I'll get to that in a minute. But at this point, all I'm doing is deciding where to look. I'm not deciding which ones to dig or anything like that. Yeah.
Can you describe how
you this one?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. This was on earlier. This is just the number of sites along this region, along this axis, and the size of the sites along this axis. I was just saying earlier that you'll find that there, at least Adams has found, and other people found in other areas, that you tend to get what's called a site hierarchy, where you have very few really big sites, which are towns or cities or something. You get a whole lot of little tiny sites, which are building our, say, farmhouses or camps. And you get past hamlets and villages in between.
Why does the backup look zero?
Right here?
It needs to go to zero. It doesn't go, not necessarily.
Oh, it could, but it doesn't have to.
I just always think it's something because you know, house and something else, there's a village, there's nothing between. Is this what
the show it can go to zero, but it doesn't have to. You can have some sites in here which are in between that area.
But there's a tendency to go very short much now.
Not always, but sometimes there is. This is when you see this distribution, it means something to someone who's studying, say, urbanism in Iraq, ancient urbanism. This would tell you that you have probably some kind of particular type of political structure, you know, city-state controlling smaller villages and so on, and so the hierarchy. But that gets often pressed off in another topic, which I don't really want to discuss right now. But it needn't go like this. You could get a very smooth thing like this. But if you had that, that would mean something totally different. And it's rather unlikely. That can be, that is, so should be purposive.
Well, what I was thinking is that if you're looking at, say, just the Iron Age mobile period, mm-hmm. then you know maybe where the boundaries were, but if you're going to pick up everything, the boundaries change.
That's why I said ideally. Because ideally we want to generalize about some ancient culture. And it would be nice, ideally, if we could sample the area where that ancient culture lived. Now, most of the time, we don't know where the boundaries were. And as you say, even when we do know where the boundaries were in one period, in another period, they'll be different. So that is a problem. And usually, what most archaeologists do is they pick, you mentioned this earlier, an environmental boundary instead. They pick the edges of a wadi, or they pick mountains or rivers as borders in these areas. Sometimes those more or less correspond. In the case of Moab, the Wadi Hasa would be the southern boundary most of the time. It's a fairly obvious place to put a boundary. So sometimes that works out really nicely. The important thing is that when you are very specifically looking for information about a cultural unit, rather than a more general cultural history of an area, that it's useful to try and make the boundaries fit that unit as closely as possible. But in most cases, I agree, you can't do that. In fact, a lot of the time, you know little enough about the area that you have to very arbitrarily map. Sometimes you need these modern roads or railway tracks or something in these edges of your survey area. So I was talking about the ideal situation. I should have pointed out that that is rarely a far about just surface collection. So far, actually, so far I haven't talked about surface collection. I've only talked about walking and finding the sites. And deciding where to look to try and find the sites. Assume for the moment you don't know where any of the sites are. That also is very true. You should know at least some of them are. Okay? Sorry, this is a little obtuse. Okay. Now, having gone through all the stuff, that's probably the same thing, the purpose of sampling. So maybe I can read a quote here from a man named Lee. He says, to reject probability sampling is to assert either that the determinants are known or that the potential bias can be measured and controlled. But if this is not true, intuitive sampling necessarily introduces uncontrolled bias. So this is basically what we're trying to avoid when we use sampling. It's not that a purpose of sample isn't good. In many cases, it's the best kind of sampling you can have. But only when you can control your bias, or you are intentionally putting bias into your survey in order to find particular things that you already know are there. Does that make sense? Okay. Next thing that I'd like to talk about, and this refers to your sheet that you've been given, are the two subjects of coverage and intensity. The other thing which is good about using an explicitly thought of sampling program is it forces you to think about these two things. Now, what I mean by intensity is the degree to which you looked for sites in the area. You can measure this either by the number of man hours per unit area. Obviously, if you had 20 people spending 3 days in an area looking for sites,